Before we jump into this week's episode, there are two important updates. The first is that the Baptist 21 panel at the SBC will once again be at breakfast this year. That will be breakfast on the Tuesday, June 11th, right before the Southern Baptist Convention starts. We will start to gather around 6:40, and then we'll have a panel made up of Al Mohler, Danny Aiken, J.D. Greer, Clint Presley, and more to come. And so if you want to sign up early, the early bird registration is $25. Again, there will be books and food, and also there will be good conversation about the most pressing topics facing the Southern Baptist Convention. You can find out more at Baptist21.com, and you can sign up there. In addition, the Pillar Network is launching a new podcast. The podcast will focus on lessons for planting and revitalization, as well as just common questions for pastoring, all done under a banner of Pillar's doctrine and DNA. There are two episodes up now. You can hear more about who Pillar is and also the origin story of how the network got started. To find out more, you can go to thepillarnetwork.com.
Baptist 21 is a pastor-led voice for Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The B21 podcast will discuss current issues in the SBC with Southern Baptist church leaders. To check out more resources, visit us at baptist21.com.
Welcome to the Baptist 21 podcast, where we have conversations about being Baptist in the 21st century. My name is Jed Coppinger, and I'm one of the founding members of Baptist 21. Every year leading up to the Southern Baptist Convention, we interview the presidential candidates, and we're doing it again this year. And today we have the opportunity to talk with Pastor Bruce Frank, pastor of the Biltmore Church, which has seven campuses in Western North Carolina. Has been there 15 years, and God has done incredible things under his leadership. Bruce, thanks for taking time to talk.
Thanks, Jed. Good to be here.
Well, we're going to hit on all the issues that you would expect for us to hit on, but we'd like to start by giving the candidates an opportunity to introduce themselves. So just briefly, Bruce, how did you come to know the Lord, and how did you get into vocational ministry?
Sure. I grew up in a good home, but not a Christian home. We didn't go to church very often. When we did, it was more, you know, more of a mainline denomination, Christmas and Easter kind of deal. But good, again, very moral mom and dad. Really, we grew up born in Atlanta, and then we went to, went to Oklahoma, my older brother, I got one older, two younger, he came to faith in Christ through some friends in Tulsa. We moved to Texas. My two younger brothers came to faith in Christ, and yeah, they walked the talk and talked the talk. So for several years, I persecuted them and tested them as best I could. And, you know, they were changed people, even though they were obviously pretty young, they were changed people. I think my brother was probably 16 or 17 when he came to Christ. The younger brothers were maybe 14. Dad passed. I'm not sure how that all orchestrated in my coming to know the Lord. But I came to know the Lord as a senior in high school. A bunch of people were praying for me that I found out later. A basketball coach led me to Christ in Wichita Falls, Texas. 17-year-old senior in high school, didn't know exactly what that even meant. I do remember driving out of the parking lot at Ryder High School in Wichita Falls thinking something just happened. A lot of the animosity was immediately gone that I had expressed toward my brothers. I mean, that was like the first fruit of the spirit that I didn't even know how to explain. went off to Texas Tech to some of my family was in banking, so I didn't, you know, at that stage I didn't have any idea what I was doing. So I went out, I was studying a finance major at Texas Tech, initially discipled at FCA through FCA, then Campus Crusades, kind of who taught me how to, you know, read, you how to have quiet time, how to pray, how to memorize scripture, how to especially how to share your faith. I mean, how do you, you know, they took me to South Padre Island, said, go, you know, go witness those drunk people over there. And, you know, that's like throw you in the deep end of the pool. It was awesome. again, my senior year was starting to actually interview with companies, and God began to take that desire away completely, replaced that with a call to ministry. Again, not growing up with that, didn't know exactly what the terminology was, but through some discipleship, showed me, you know, hey, this is a call to ministry. Initially, I thought college ministry because that's all I knew. But then he specified that toward leading a local church. Went back home, Wichita Falls, to kind of put some money away for a seminary. Then went to Southwestern. Again, I had my first staff position. I literally went to the placement office. And back in those days, you had 3x5 index cards on a bulletin board. And so I didn't have any connections or any of that kind of stuff. So I literally took I took a 3x5 card out. It was like youth pastor at Palo Pinto, Texas, which is an hour and a half west of Fort Worth. I started there. Pastor was super gracious. He's like, preach all you want. So I started preaching there. Met my wife. Her dad was a minister of music there in Fort Worth. We got married about halfway through. She was a nursing student. I was in seminary, obviously. 2 years in, we got married. 2 years later, we graduated the same day. So we had one of those weeks on those stress tests that was kind of off the charts. We both graduated. She had Tyler, our firstborn, like 3 days later. We took our first pastorate 3 days after that. But it was great. I mean, we pastored a little church in North Texas called Blue Grove Baptist Church, and they were awesome. Seriously, they were. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing at all. They raised us more than anything. You know, we were in a parsonage in the back of a Sudan field, and they were great. I mean, seriously, they were amazing. Fast forward a little bit, was an XP in Houston for about 5 years, where I learned kind of a lot of the stuff that I think helped me about systems and personnel and things like that. Then pastored what used to be known as First Baptist Humble, which is northeast suburbs of Houston. Chris Kuba is there now. Glad he's doing. I mean, he's doing great work there. But we moved here in 2008. Wife's name is Lori. We've got two boys. One Tyler is one of our campus pastors. The other one's name is Connor, and he works up in Babylon, better known as New York City. And we got two beautiful little granddaughters. Which, not having any sisters or daughters, man, that's awesome. That's amazing. So again, we've been here 15 years. And it's been an amazing ride. I mean, COVID was a little hard, but it taught us some things as well. But, you know, we came here and they had a lot of good strengths already. Their strengths were kind of my weaknesses, and maybe some of my strengths were maybe the church's weaknesses. And it's been a great marriage. Again, 15 years, seen some amazing things happen. We went multi-site in 2012, because if you've been in Western North Carolina, egress is an issue. It got to the point where, you know, it was 45 minutes to get people off the campus. So we didn't know if it'd work here in the mountains, and God's been gracious and allowed us to reach a lot of people. So we've seen a lot of people saved, which that's what motivates me. I know we're going to segue in a minute to why you're running, but for me, it's Great Commission. There's nothing like the joy and unity that comes from not growing up in church. I still remember what it's like to be lost. That motivates me. I love a lot of stuff about ministry, but we see a lot of adults saved and baptized here, which, I mean, it counts. I mean, children and all that stuff is amazing. But I tell you what, there's just nothing like the unifying factor of seeing just week after week after week, men and women, you know, with tattoos, with no background, all different walks of life. There's just nothing as unifying as that. And that's a great joy.
Yeah, absolutely. And energizing and all the rest. Oh. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Well, let me push pause on that to hop into some of these lighthearted rapid fire questions that we hit everybody with. Then I'd love to hear more about that. We all would. All right. Real quick. Favorite sport
to play currently, or just favorite sport in general?
In general.
You know, if I'm going to watch something, it'll be NFL.
All right.
If I'm going to play something, it'll probably be golf.
Okay. Favorite NFL team, just while we're on that?
I'm Houston Texans. I mean, I got to. It's been a long and winding journey, but it is now happy times are here again.
All right. Favorite Christmas gift as a kid?
Puppy. Golden Retriever puppy.
Favorite athlete?
I don't know if golf's a sport, but I'm liking Scottie Scheffler quite a bit right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy what he's doing. Jordan or LeBron?
That's not even a question. That's Jordan. 100% of the time.
There you go.
He doesn't flop.
There you go. First time you preached a sermon, what was the text? Do you remember?
Yeah, first time was at a flea market in Grand Prairie, Texas. And I don't remember what it was, but the first one in a church was, I think it was Luke 9 about take up your cross and follow me. It was not, you know, you have a lot of zeal and very little wisdom. And I think I was done in 21 minutes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's great. Well, yeah, let's get into the nomination a little bit more. So who's nominating you? And then, you know, you kind of touched on this already, but why are you allowing your name to be nominated for president?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm privileged. John Mark Harrison. John Mark was actually, you know, when we got to Biltmore, he was the student pastor. After that, he was our first campus pastor, and just I've always had great respect for him. I knew he was going to be a senior pastor, so I was the whole, you know, we were talking about all of that. Recommended him to Apex back in the day, and just watching him flourish and grow as I'm kind of a, you know, probably a little older than a big brother, but a little younger than a dad. But I would say kind of a semi mentor. I learn as much from him as he does from me. But you know, there was a number of people to kind of think about, but for me, I mean, I talk with him anyway, probably every month. We talk church, utmost respect for him. He's seen my leadership style, good, bad, or indifferent, for 15 years. So he was an easy choice.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the other question. Was it?
So, you know, and you touched on this earlier, but just kind of, you know, what are the tangible things you hope to accomplish, or why allow your name to be nominated for president?
You know, Jed, I mean, I got approached probably as early as September by several people. And at the time, you know, church was just starting to flourish again right out of COVID. So it was fun, you know, for everybody. It was a challenging couple of years. So it's like, man, why would I do that? And I said, I'll be glad to pray about it. I had my 15-year sabbatical, I think, in kind of that October, November timeframe. And I read through the book of Acts over and over and over and over and over and over again. And God it was great to get caught up in the drama of the spread of the gospel. And I remember Acts 13:52, it says the disciples were filled with joy in the Holy Spirit. And that was sort of a culmination of what God had been trying to teach me with some of the last few years, whether that be COVID or the task force or whatever it was, just some of the, you know, okay, you got to get your joy back. You got to, you know, and that's only going to be being by filled by the Spirit. So I say all that to say, probably by the first of the year, it had grown from 5% to, like, you know, it's not a no, but it's, I got to have a yes for this, because I assumed what it might cost. And so, you know, January, there are some more people, and I, like you, if you're trying to discern God's will and not a very clear, here's a verse, you know, you come from, you pray a lot, you get in the scriptures a lot, and you also get a lot of counsel. And so I started getting more and more counsel. I started getting more encouragement. I started seeing some issues that maybe, at least they weren't being talked about, I'll put it that way, that is my passion. And I thought, you know, I'm not good at a lot of things, but I'm pretty good at getting people to focus on something. And that kind of goes back into, and I have a lot of respect for the ones that I don't know some of the guys that are running. I know the ones I do know, I would consider friends and have great respect, but I still felt like the Lord was saying, at least allow your name to be put in there and he'll deal with what comes from that. So that's kind of was the journey. It did take a while, but feel very obedient allowing John Mark to do the nomination.
Yeah, no, that's great. So if you were to become president, you know, are there things that on your mind that you would really just, these are the things, these are the priorities of what you would hope to accomplish, you know, what tangible things, just things that you would love to see happen if God gives you that role?
Yeah, I would say, and I tried to spell these out on the website. If somebody wants to read it in detail, those are especially the ones that aren't forced on you that you have to deal with. But the top two right there, the first one is a focus on the Great Commission. And I don't mean that. I know everybody says that, but I know I've been blessed just to be a part of churches that see a lot of life change. And I know that's not normative. I mean, the normative church is, you know, 100 people in the normative church, not the normative church, but 22,000 out of our 48,000 churches can go a whole year and never see a baptism, never see that story. And that, you know, and that's hard. I mean, that's difficult. That's hard on a pastor just to see that. Cause I mean, these pastors, they love God. They're faithful. They're preaching the gospel. And so my burden would be, you know, what can we do? And I know it goes down to the local level and the state level. I'm talking to the state execs pretty soon. And the idea would be, you know, how do we help those? How do we folk equip, encourage, what resource, whatever you need to do? I mean, if you just think about those 22,000 that didn't see a baptism last year, the unity in our convention is in general and those churches specifically, if they just saw like a person come to faith in Christ and follow, I know baptism's not an exact metric, but it is the metric we have. The multiplying effect of that would be my first thing. I mean, my first meeting would be a Zoom call with the state executives and maybe some of the associational people. I was like, what do you need from me? What can I do to help you? Because the closer you get to the front lines, the better the answers are. Mm-hmm. I believe that in a church level. I mean, if I have a question about children's ministry, don't ask me. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm going to ask somebody that is a subject matter expert, and those are the subject matter experts. They know the church, and a lot of pastors also are struggling coming out of COVID. I mean, I was looking at some Guidestone stuff where like mental health of pastors coming out of COVID, a lot of them are, you know, I'm going to lose my church, all of that stuff. And healthy pastors often are indicative of a healthy church, not always, but oftentimes. So that would be my passion, because 100 years from now, Jed, 100 years from now, I mean, first of all, seeing people saved is why I got into ministry, why I felt called to ministry. But 100 years from now, what's going to matter? I mean, heaven is real, hell is real. And what's going to matter 100 years from now are the souls of men and women. I honestly believe that. And so I think we've had some mission drift as a convention. Maybe some of it was necessary. Maybe some of it was unnecessary. But bottom line, we have had a mission drift. When you have 80% of the churches are plateaued or declining, that's a bad trend. That's not a trend that any organization can sustain over a. And if we don't change it in 20 years, you can do the math. It's not hyperbole or sensationalism. That is just math. And my main focus would be, how do we help, especially those churches that, you know, struggle to see that? That would be my first focus. I mean, the other ones that might, you know, getting them to have a little more, that's great. But I know the multiplying effect. If a church that hadn't seen something in a year or two, if they just saw, like, it might be helping them put a VBS on, might be helping them do whatever. If they just saw a little bit. I mean, I know at Blue Grove, my first pastorate, honestly, did not have a stoplight. I mean, it didn't have a stoplight. And when I got there, it was 100 people in the church. And but there is a way to still, you know, to get into that community. There is. So that's my heart. That would be my focus. The first one. The second one that is obviously not as fun and joyful, but I do think we need to have a bit more tenacity on the sexual abuse issue. I definitely think we've had a big improvement since like 2018. Since 2018, I think churches are making, you know, they're making the right phone call. Instead of trying to do it on their own, they're calling the association, calling the state, you know, what do I do here? So that's, you know, the culture itself has improved. I do think the missing link, and I don't know exactly how this will play out. I haven't been a part of those meetings since chairing since the original task force. I haven't been since then. So I know there's a lot of stuff behind it, but I do think it's very important we figure out a way. If you just look statistically, the vast majority, no matter what survey I look at, the vast majority of abusers are not arrested. I think it's like 3% are arrested, 3% are convicted. And this is a cultural issue. It's not just a church issue. It's a cultural issue. But as churches, we are uniquely vulnerable because we deal with volunteers and we deal with a lot of children. By definition, that's what we do. And so that unique aspect, no matter how you look at the stats, although there's been a lot of improvement, I think most of it's been at the state level and the associational level. I think Al Mohler said the same thing. That deal, he said, there's got to be some structural change whereby we don't let a bad guy move from church to church that maybe wasn't arrested, but and maybe wasn't convicted, but you know, I mean, maybe there was something shady and he got passed on, but then passed on. I don't want him working in your church and my church, you know, even a background check wouldn't catch that because there wasn't an arrest. So there's got to be some way. Other organizations have done it. Sports organizations have done it. I don't know the answer to it, but I do know the issue of it. And so I think if you get the best around the table, if you get the entity heads, seminary presidents, I think there is another step to take. And I know people get tired of it. but hard things are hard. And that's a hard thing. We kind of pushed it, in my opinion. If we'd have dealt with this 20, 25 years ago, maybe like we could have, we would not be in, you know, we would not be having to, you know, kind of change the tire going 60 miles an hour, which is what it feels like. And that's why it is hard. But again, Baptists have done hard things. But Baptists at our best are Great Commission focus at our best. I mean, our best, that's the unity, the gospel and evangelism. That's what unifies us, with the assumption of doctrinal clarity as well, obviously.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, you hit on another number of things there, and I know you could talk about other issues as well. I mean, as you think about the SBC just as at large, how would you rate the state of the SBC, you know, and why that rating? I mean, it could be scale to 1 to 10, you know, whatever. But, you know, you step into a new church, you've got to evaluate strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. You've got to, you know, but as you kind of take that mindset into the church, how would you describe, rate the state of the SBC?
You know, I mean, like at a church, you might have five different areas you rate differently. And I think that'd be fair with the SBC. It'd be hard to put one number because some areas we're strong in. I mean, the strongest areas we have, were obviously super strong doctrinally, as well as, you know, you've got some denominations that have gone off the deep end, they've gone away from the Bible. Even in the difficult issues, I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. I mean, the SBC is holding strong to God's word. I mean, I do believe that, you know, I mean, I went to Southwestern back in the day. I heard stuff there that even at that point, a fairly new believer, even, you know, I mean, I've been discipled maybe 4 or 5 years, but even then I was like, hey, it didn't sound exactly right. And so I have great appreciation for that. I don't hear that stuff very often. I mean, there might be a handful that, you know, and they're going to be happier in a different tribe, obviously. But, you know, you've got some that were strong in that area. I do understand Twitter is not necessarily a indication. I mean, I learned that during the task force. You know, if you looked at Twitter, that would be very different than the 90% that raised their hand for that. So I understand Twitter is kind of driven by outrage and stuff like that. You know, obviously there appears to be some, you know, lack of communication, some trust issues that need to be dealt with. There's some differences of opinion of obviously, you know, law is kind of, I think it's doesn't need to be as divisive as it is. And I'll try to make, you know, I'm going to try to explain it in a non-divisive way. It's hard to rate. I think the biggest thing we have is opportunity. I mean, foreign mission force is strong. You've got, you know, some of the vital signs don't look good on paper as far as decline and that kind of stuff. The culture has changed for sure. But I think when you pull back some of those statistics, some of the stuff that has gone down is what I would just term cultural Christianity. You know, they used to check the box Christian. Now they check the box none. But as far as practicing believers, those kind of things, it's a lot easier to share the gospel with somebody who knows they're lost than somebody who, you know, comes to church Easter and Christmas and has sort of a comfort level. So again, there's pros and cons. SBC has a lot of potential. I think the best days are ahead for the SBC. I think the seminaries are led by conservative leaders. That's a big plus. I mean, I love Dr. Chitwood and Dr. Ezell. I have a lot of confidence in both of those guys. So, you know, when it comes to leadership and entity heads and all that stuff, you know, super strong, a little bit of disunity right now. Some of that's driven by the culture we're in. You know, our culture is very, there's not a lot of dialogue going on just culturally. And that is definitely, you know, you get a lot more clicks if you call somebody a liberal than you do if you try to deal with an issue. But at the same time, I mean, having these discussions, there's a lot of amazing people in the SBC, and there's a lot of amazing leaders. I got to meet most of them when I was doing the task force, where I was like, man, these are some very strong leaders, the executive directors, the entity heads. I mean, those guys and ladies are very strong.
Yeah, no, that's good. So we seem to be divided. And there are some who think actually a little bit more division might be helpful that there needs to be a harder line. Others are saying, no, there needs to be more unity. And there's a lot of people who are wrestling with a lot of those things as it relates to things like the law amendment. So one of the major issues, obviously, right now, that Southern Baptists are going to vote on for the second time is the law amendment. So just, you know, what are your thoughts on the law amendment? You touched on it briefly just a second ago, but, you know, how do you think Southern Baptists should think about the law amendment?
Sure. And let me start off, not in a defensive posture, but I lead my family in a complementarian way, and I lead my churches. I've always done that. I've never had I've never had a lady with the title of pastor in 30 plus years of ministry. I'm not waffling on that at all. I have no intention of any of those changes in the future. So with that being said, I mean, I strongly believe the Bible teaches that, you know, what that the pastor, elder, shepherd is qualified males only. My concern, I mean, in a nutshell, I know we live in a kind of a soundbite era. In a nutshell, I just think what Adrian Rogers and the team on the Baptist Faith and Message did is better than the law amendment. I think the law amendment is a downgrade for two reasons. Number one, it actually raises, in my opinion, it raises more questions than it answers. And it opens the door to extra biblical application. Those would be the two big things. Number one, I mean, again, it's not, you know, I think the Baptist Faith and Message hit that balance between biblical fidelity and, you know, a missional focus. You know, they hit those two. And you're always trying, you always have to guard against liberalism. You always have to guard against getting away from the Bible. But it's not it's not an either or. It's we've shown it can be a both and. My questions, when I say it raises more questions than it does answers, I mean, I've raised these questions and I've yet to see a sufficient answer. What I've seen is accusations and this is your, you know, closet, whatever. And I'm just saying, when somebody won't answer the questions clearly, then I think the questions are, I think it's showing that they're valid. For me, you know, I've asked the question, okay, is this about title or function? And it's an important question to ask because, you know, first of all, if it's about title, there is, depending on which one you look at, there's 0.02% of Southern Baptist churches, I think it's 1,200 out of 48,000, have a woman pastor title. 0.02%. Anything less than 1% is typically considered an insignificant number. So you've got a very small percentage. I think if you can kick Saddleback, largest church in the denomination, out for that reason, the mechanism exists. I know that the Credential Committee is somewhat overloaded. About 80% of their cases are sexual abuse cases. So you've got 9 people, 2 of whom I think are still seminary students. I mean, that is, they don't appear to be resourced enough, you know, from what I can tell. But the first question, you know, title or function, if it's about function, then you got to ask the question, then what is, because the question that they were asked to do is, what is a pastor? I don't see the law amendment answering the question. I hear people say, everybody knows what a pastor is. I would challenge that to say that the average Southern Baptist, when they think pastor, if the average Southern Baptist church is 100 people, they definitely think senior pastor, preaching pastor, the one that, you know, but again, and even now you're like, okay, what is exclusively pastoral? And the reason that's important is I think some of the stronger proponents of the law amendment have not been shy in saying it is about function, because you'll take the passage out of 1 Timothy chapter 2, 12, 13, and 14, and it says, I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. And then they will take exercise authority and then say, if it's about function, any female exercising authority over any male is your pastoring. The problem is when you look at the Bible and it says, here's what a pastor is to do, there's a lot of stuff that everybody's supposed to do. Defend the church, you know, visit the sick, pray, all that. I think we have to identify, either have it as in the Baptist Faith and Message like it is, or identify what is it that says this is exclusively pastoral. The IMB has a little bit more detail in their training when they talk about pastoral leadership, kind of like elder overseer. And then secondly, you know, they talk about the preaching function. And so at least that gives a little more clarity to that. I know JD and those guys, there's guys a lot smarter than me, have talked about the issues they have on the front end about, and I know the cooperation committee is talking about, where does that go? My concern is I haven't heard the answer. I mean, I don't even know, what does the answer to a firm mean? If it means to appoint, employ, or a firm, what does a firm mean? Does that mean if, you know, if you had somebody come and preach and their church has, you know, I mean, has a woman pastor, is that affirming that? Does that mean it's not, this isn't, and I'll tell you the reason this is not a red herring. These are legitimate questions. Does that mean if you have a person in accounting or a person that's in preschool, like I have a children's director that oversees a lot of both people as well as volunteers? I know some have said they should not actually, because she's given leadership to, let's say, you know, volunteers, that some of those are men, some of those are women. I mean, I have a lady on my personnel team that's somewhat of an authority over me. I mean, they're great, but I mean, is that going to be part about exercising authority? And the reason that's not a red herring, and the reason it I know people say it's not in the amendment, but if it says a pastor of any kind, is that pastoring of any kind? Is that, that's why I go back to title or function. So another example would be, it was only a couple of years ago when a presidential candidate for SBC said that he would not have a female as a chair of any SBC committee. Well, that certainly is not title. And then was unclear on whether any female could be on any SBC committee. So my point is the fact that it's not the, if we're going to upgrade what Adrian and BF&M did, if we need to revise it, and there's, I'm not saying that it's not, that's why my first thought was it's understandable, because our culture is blurring the lines of gender and all of that stuff. It's understandable to look at it. I think this is a downgrade because it doesn't answer the question, what is a pastor? It confuses title and function. And the biggest thing is it opens the door to extra biblical. I'm not going to say unbiblical. I'm going to say extra biblical actions that are not just red herrings. They have, you know, people have expressed it on Twitter and other places that, you know, it is about function. We just haven't decided what is exclusively a pastor. Is it the preaching? Is it leading? I think that needs to be answered to be better than what Adrian and the guys put down back in 2000. It's a long answer. I know it can get in the weeds, but since we have an hour, that was going to be it.
No, I mean, that is one of the key issues. And, you know, I know of complementarian pastors who are for it. I know some who are against it. I think generally those who are against it, their plea is something like I'm hearing you say, which is, if it does pass, please show some discretion and some wisdom in the application. But you're against it because of concerns that it would lead. It's just a tightening of the screws.
You know, it's about who are we going to cooperate with. And again, if a church, first, again, it's important to understand this is less than 1%. So this is in no way any kind of crisis, so to speak. We've shown we have a mechanism to deal with it. And so if we're going to upgrade, if we're going to try to define it, then at least answer the question, what is a pastor? And if you're going to codify it, you better answer that question. Every word matters in a constitution, as you know, much less in about every single word matters. And I'm saying that it raises more questions. And again, I would say again, on a friend, this isn't going to affect our church any, because I mean, I have no female pastors. But the thing is, it's not going to affect the Great Commission. I mean, it's not going to affect the Great. This is not. And if we're going to spend, again, I'd rather spend our focus on 80% of the churches that are struggling versus 0.02% of the churches. There is a way, if a church is egalitarian, they do need to go to another tribe. It's not who we are. We are complementarian, convictional complementarian. We probably need to state that more clearly. I just don't think the law amendment is. I think it's poorly written. It's not helpful. In my opinion, it's very, very, it's not nearly an upgrade on what the BF&M guys did in 2000. So that's basically it. If it gets passed. Yeah. I mean, I know some guys that I respect a lot. They said, well, that would never happen. The Southern Baptist Convention would never put up with, you know, basically the witch hunt you're talking about. Maybe not. I think that's maybe a tad naive. Maybe I'm cynical. Maybe they're naive. Maybe there's something in between. But why open it up when you already have a mechanism in place? So if we're going to change it, let's improve it. Let's not make it worse.
Well, I mean, so, you know, one of the things that the law amendment has highlighted, I think, is that that Southern Baptists don't all have the same perspective on cooperation. Some thought we were cooperating with these kinds of rules, and others thought with these kinds of rules. And so, you know, one of the things that we have in place is a cooperation committee that is working on something. I'm not sure who knows what it is exactly, but just kind of help think through that closely. What does it mean to be Southern Baptist? How closely do we have to identify? I do think, you know, that, you know, you heard about the affirmation, which you raised, you know, you heard about non-contradiction, you know, or, you know, somewhere in between. You know, when you think about the cooperation committee, do you have any hopes or, you know, on what it is that they come back with?
You know, I mean, I hope so. There's some great folks on that committee. I can't imagine. I think there's 20 people on there.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
I think it's 20 people with that task. I mean, that'd be like herding cats. I don't even know how you do it. I think it's the right question. You have to ask that question at some point. There has to be some definition. But I'm not sure if it will have an immediate impact, but I think it'll have a, whatever they come up with will probably have an eventual. I don't think it'll make a big difference with law. I think it'll make a big difference maybe down the line when it gets kind of worked through the system. It's a necessary question to ask. I'm not sure if it'll help with this one.
Yeah. What about, so you mentioned your experience, I mean, chairing the sexual abuse task force. Now we're at the implementation phase that there should be some things coming to the floor at the Southern Baptist Convention related to that. How would you describe, I know you're on the outside now, looking in to a certain degree, how would you describe where we are as it relates to all of that? You touched on a little bit earlier, and, you know, what do you think needs to happen to move things forward?
It's a great question. Again, I haven't been in the meetings with everybody from attorneys to entity heads, all that kind of stuff. So I got to be a little bit general because I could be in a meeting, you know, if I ended up getting elected, I could be in a meeting in month two and go, that's obvious why that happened. So with that caveat, you know, I don't have a strong opinion. Should it be inside or outside the SBC? There's pros and cons on both of those. As far as the form, you know, you do have pros and cons on both sides. Both of them were discussed way back in, you know, in 22. There's a large learning curve for me, for sure, and really for half the people on that team, big learning curve. So as I said earlier, I do think we've got it is hard. I mean, all this it's hard because of everything from our polity to the legal framework we live in to, I mean, it's hard on every aspect. To the mere subject matter breaks your heart, all those kind of things. I do think, though, we do have to have enough tenacity. We can do hard things. We've done hard things in the past. People that don't even have the Spirit of God, organizations that are not even believers, they have something like this, all right, that can provide. The missing piece I mentioned earlier, we have to figure out a way. There's been improvement for sure, but there has to be a way for a church that doesn't have the resources that your church or my church has that can get something where I might not want to put this guy working with students. And maybe it's not a conviction, and maybe it's not an arrest that would come up, you know, because again, that's going to take at most that, I mean, at most, that's 20% at most. And I think we do better. But as you know, as well as I do, back in the day, 20 years ago, you know, guys that had something questionable, they would be let go, maybe even have a little party for them. And they would go down the road. And within 80% of those guys have a recidivism rate. You know what happened? I mean, it is what it is. And the question is, you can't stop it because it's a cultural deal, but we certainly can. We look in the mirror and say, we put systems in place, even if they were painful, even if they cost some money, to try to limit that 80% to make it super hard for somebody to just, because abusers are like those raptors on Jurassic Park. I mean, they really are. They're always like, they're like testing the fence all the time. Where is there a place like the fence is down? You know, and the normative Southern Baptist Church, other than looking at arrests and convictions, might not have the necessary interview processes or screening processes and those kind of things. So the question is, how do we, in a fair way, a wise way, all right, nobody's asking to be foolish. How do you do that in a wise way that basically gives a resource to, you know, Mr. Pastor, who's, or bivocational pastor, for him to be able to just do a quick last, you know, hey, for this guy, before I put him in there with the four-year-olds, he's okay. She's okay. That's the missing piece right now. How it gets done, I don't have the specifics. I know it can be done because other places have done it. So it can be done. It's just going to take some work. I do think if you get the entity heads, the attorneys, if everybody gets around a table, I think it can be done. I'm not sure what form it looks like, but I think it can be done and not get away from polity. You know, I know people are like, why am I paying for the church down the road? That's really not what it's about as much. It's not about, you know, opening up the floodgates. It's about how do you have some kind of resourcing, just like associations and states do anyway. They resource churches. How do you resource churches in this very crucial area? Because it's a, I mean, besides the damage to a victim, obviously, I mean, that's a showstopper for, you know, I mean, in pastors, we didn't learn this in seminary. At least maybe they are now. I know when I went to Southwestern, I didn't have anything like this. Who do you call? What do you do when you get that phone call? Because statistically, chances are if you're in ministry for a good length of time, that call is going to come. And what you do right, what you do next is what we've improved on. The states and the local, they've really done some good job. Now, at least we don't immediately jump to stupid. We at least immediately try to get some help. And that's a big step. The missing piece is, how do you take care of the majority of people that aren't going to show up on a Google search?
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. One of the questions we ask presidential candidates every year is, you know, related to their CP giving. They hear this from a number of people. How does your church give to the CP and why?
Yeah. I mean, we give in raw dollars. I mean, they put the dollars in there. We do a dollar amount. I think it's $235,000 to CP. I think it goes up this year to like $250 or something. And then we give Lottie and Annie. I think what's not shown in the CP or in the ACP, it's like it didn't show, you know, we give to the associations as well. What's not really shown is, you know, as you get opportunities, like there's a lot of SBC church plants that we give directly to, whether that's right or wrong, we just give directly, whether it be the SBC church plant in Myrtle Beach, the SBC church plant in Jacksonville, the SBC church plant in Atlanta, the SBC church plant in Brooklyn, the SBC church plant in London, et cetera, et cetera. Those are just 30,000 here, 40,000 here, 30,000 here, da, da, da. Those don't show up. So I would say the challenge, and I've talked to this about, I think I was doing another one earlier this morning, another podcast this morning. I remember sitting in a meeting about 10 years ago, and it dawned on me as I sat around a bunch, I won't name the names, but they were like, oh, CP giving, people are going away from CP giving and blah, 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 blah. And one of the things, and this was 10 years ago, it's even more so now, that I think not easily, it's simple, but it's not, it's a lot of work, is we have to tell, I mean, we live in a world now, but brand loyalty is not there. So I think it's a fool's errand to simply challenge, like the average age of my church is like, just adults is like 36. They don't know Lottie Moon, Annie Armstrong. Maybe you say they should, and maybe they should. I would much rather them get a kingdom mindset and then lead them to that. But I think better would be if we tell the story, how we have to tell the story, how come this is the best kingdom investment versus, I mean, nowadays they can go on Google and find 20 very great ministries. I think IMB, I think Sin Relief, I think all those things. We need to tell the story. How come this is the best, or at least close to the best investment? How come you should do this versus Compassion International? How come you should do this instead of the Ocoa Refuge Center? And I think that's the part that is missing. And 20 years ago, you could say, hey, I don't even know about those. You don't even know those. But now 20 years, you can find very good ministries to give to. And I do believe SBC stuff and their stuff, the Lord, I mean, IMB, largest missionary force in modern history. Somebody corrected me the other day when I said it, and I'm like, okay, foreign mission force in the, you know, but I mean, shit, when those guys do an amazing job, it is unique in modern Christian history in some ways. I think Ezel does a great job. Church planning stuff is great. I love Vance Pittman. I mean, those guys do great. What I think we can all do, I bet you most of our folks don't even know this, like our disaster relief is, you know, I think it's second only to Red Cross. I guess my point, Jed, is this. The biggest thing we can do, or if I was president, is like, man, we got to tell the story. People give the stories. Why is compassion a billion-dollar industry? Not industry. How come they're a billion-dollar company? For many reasons, but one of the things they do is they personalize this thing. Like, Lori and I sponsor, I think, 6 kids. I get letters and write letters to those 6 kids. There's a personal connection. I mean, I see the story. That can be done. It's not easy, but that's the world we live in. It's a flat world in regards to people can see 100 different places, ministries. We have to answer the question. I think the day is gone where you can just say, you ought to give to Lottie Moon. I think that day is gone. I think the day you can say, here is why this, whether it be Lottie Moon, Annie Armstrong, or CP, this is why this is a kingdom investment. And you got to tell, I mean, your church, I would imagine, is pretty young. You're having to tell those 30-year-old businessmen who and business ladies who do this for a living, what's the ROI on this? What is the kingdom investment on this? And I just think we can do there's stories of God at work all over the place in SBC life. We got to tell those in some kind of macro way.
Yeah, no, that's good. Hey, as we make our way towards Indianapolis, final question here, just a final word or encouragement for Southern Baptist.
Yeah, I would say, what has united us in our best? So, I mean, Southern Baptist at our best, we hold tightly to the message. We hold tightly to the message of the Bible. We do not, I was in seminary when there was some of that coming back to the Bible. Very grateful for that. That is not the same problem now. We still have issues, but I mean, when we are at our best, we hold tightly to the Bible. The message does not change. But we also realize, I mean, again, 100 years from now, I would simply say this, when we're dead, I mean, what's going to matter the most, assuming doctrinal clarity, is not maybe those fine points of disagreement, but as man, did we do all we could to leverage all that God has given us? God's given a bunch of stuff to the SBC. I mean, just given a lot of 48,000 churches. That's a lot of, I mean, Christendom is a lot bigger than the SBC. I mean, I hope people know that. I mean, it is, yes, it's technically the largest Protestant denomination. But listen, man, God can go and use anybody he wants to. And he tends to use people who focus on what he focuses on, and what he focuses on are the souls of men and women. And that is when we are our best. We hold the Bible tightly, but we are mission focused. And again, if I end up having, and it would be a privilege, if I'm the privilege, you know, get the privilege of leading, that's where my resources are mainly going to go on, is how do we get back to winning people? How do we equip those 22,000 to see the joy in a family's face when their prodigal 22-year-old son who'd been strung out on meth, when he comes to repentance and faith in Christ and sees them baptized? That's church changing. And you multiply that times many, and that's convention changing, and then eventually world changing. That would be my message.
Yeah. Well, Bruce, thanks for taking time to talk today. Appreciate the conversation. Praying for you and SBC as we approach the convention. Just want to say, quick reminder, the Baptist 21 panel this year is on Tuesday morning, not lunch. It's 6:45 a.m. We're going to be in the Indiana Roof Ballroom. It's about 4 minutes from the convention center. You have Dr. Moeller, J.D. Greer, Dr. Aiken, and others. We'll have books, breakfast, and talk about the most pressing issues for Southern Baptist this year. Seats are limited. Go to Baptist21.com to sign up. And thanks for listening to the Baptist 21 podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Baptist 21 podcast. To learn more about us, visit us at our website, Baptist21.com. Also, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with others. It would really help us out. If you ever have thoughts or ideas for future interviews, please reach out to us at our email, baptist21@gmail.com. Again, thanks for listening to the podcast.